I was exposed by Hope Not Hate as the head of the Hundreds at Handers. All of a sudden, on my way to work, I was arrested, turned the house upside down, took absolutely every electronic device. I was informed that it was distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred. They began questioning me. Like, you're looking at 10 years. The whole trial was basically like a character assassination to be able to paint me as a racist who the judge explicitly said that he's using this to make an example of political activists. They quickly put me in a solo cell because I'm like a known racist and a known... Is there a word for someone who like hates paedophiles? I can't be allowed near these people and I can't possibly be in the same cell as them because it'd just be assumed that I'd attack them. They've ended up with egg on the face because they've made me more prominent than ever. Before this, I was merely like Laura Towler's husband. Now I've got a name to myself and Laura's being referred to as Samuelia's wife, you know? It's like, yeah.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is a man who has been, he's only now allowed to speak. He's been in prison, then he's been on probation and all kinds of things, and he's only now allowed to speak, and that is Mr. Sam Melia, and he is the author of a very interesting new book called Legal, Truthful, Guilty, Diary of a Political Prisoner. Sam, hello.
Hey, Ed. Pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so... How did you, I mean, you seem like quite a sort of well-spoken, articulate kind of a chap. So how on earth did you end up in this situation of jail and struggle sessions of a Maoist kind and all of this kind of, your family having to go through awful, taking away from your children and even trying to stop you from seeing your children because of your political views, all this kind of thing. Tell me a bit about your background. How did you get to that point?
I don't think I was especially political growing up or anything. I think it was around 2015 when I was in my mid-20s when I kind of started getting more engaged with these things. And it just came about through surfing about the internet and you'd begin to read more and more and it kind of expand your horizons. And it was during the rise of Trump when there was the kind of mass online censorship, people's YouTube channels getting shut down, Twitter accounts closed and everything. And I thought, if this... these messages, these kind of pro-white messages and everything, they need to still get out there. And it seems like they're shutting down all these networks that they'd started to map out. So I thought I'd take it back to the streets and I thought I'd do it via stickers. I'd seen them all around my city. It seemed to be an accepted form of political expression. You know, Socialist Workers' Party's posters are fly-posted all over the place and everything doesn't seem to get them in trouble. So I thought, all right, stickers, we'll go with that. And I designed a methodology that worked for me, so it was all entirely anonymous. All the output would be filtered through me. I'd designed the stickers. Each one would be numbered as well, so they had a solid reference point.
This was so people couldn't put up stickers purporting to be you.
Yes, yeah. And so that if someone nefarious, you know, like a left, put up a sticker that has something really inflammatory on it, and attributed it to me, I'd be able to say, it's like, well, no, we've got the hard copy of the archive from, you know, September 2021, whatever it was, and it's like, it would have a reference there. It's like 170, and it hasn't changed at all since its publication. So you saying 170 actually says this, I've got, you know, a solid proof.
And let's go back a bit, though, before we look at the stickers. So how did you left school. You're from from where are you in the country?
I'm from Leeds.
From Leeds.
Yeah, and to be honest, didn't do amazingly in school. I've never been the best behind a desk. I did about half a year of A levels, and I just couldn't stand being in the kind of school environment anymore. And initially, I was going to join the army, but my mum convinced me to get some sort of qualification prior to that. So I ended up going to Leeds Building College and getting doing a sign making course, and from that went straight into the working world, and I was in sign making for. I think I was with the same company for 9 years. No kind of high level education or anything like that.
Okay, but then you got involved in naughty politics though, in your late
in the kind of early to mid 20s, just started reading more and initially as like I think the very first kind of political event I went to was a National Action demonstration up in Darlington, I think it was. And I just kind of tagged along at the back and everything, and it seemed to go all right. Couldn't hear anything that was being said. And then we retired to the pub afterwards, and no one seemed to want to talk to me. So I was going, all right, and took myself off and looked around at the rest of the political landscape at the time. And the EDL was still, you know, quite basically the movement at the time. But that didn't seem to really jive with who I was. And it just didn't seem like my scene. So there wasn't really anything for me to get stuck into. So with a complete dearth of anything to do, I thought I'll do my own thing, and have it just completely centered on, you know, the output that I want to put out there. And a lot of it was basically recycling the rhetoric that, you know, YouTubers, people like yourself had kind of put out there, and putting it on stickers so it'd be on a, you know, street furniture.
But by the time the stickers came to light and became came back to bite you, as it were, you got involved with Patriotic Alternative?
Yes, yeah. And at that point, I'd started to wind the sticker thing down. At that point, I'd been doing it, was it 2019? So I'd been doing it for 5 years at that point. And really, I found with 300 so stickers in the archive, I was kind of recycling the same talking points, you know, because, I mean, they're kind of evergreen within our political thing. It's like, so I was like, I was designing new ones and being like, I basically just reworded these two other ones and everything. So I was winding it down. And with Patriotic Alternative, when I attended their first conference, at which you were a speaker, the people I was surrounded by, I was kind of like, oh, these seem more my kind of people. And the talk at the time was kind of like a, you know, going for power and everything. And I was like, yeah, this seems to be the way forward. So when
how were they your kind of people? What is your kind of people?
I was just looking around them, and it's like, it seemed to be people who I got along well with. I mean, I never attended like any EDL things or anything like that, but it's like, it just, I've never been into football. So, and that's, it seemed to be a heavy link between the kind of football ultras and this kind of thing kind of fed into the EDL things, and a lot of things surrounded kind of football events, and it just didn't seem like my crowd. I didn't care about football or anything like that.
No, I once pretended to be interested in football for about a year just to fit in. Between the age of 9 and 10, a kid said to me, "What football team do you support?" I said, "I don't really like football."
So, yeah, so, it's like, so, well, so, must be rugby then. And it's like,
I said to my dad, "What's the football team around here?" "Wimbledon." And that's what I said. And that was an absurd. "Oh, just because they won the FA Cup."
And then, yeah, now you're a glory chaser.
88. And so then I got into it. I went to a few matches. You know, I forced myself to be into this thing. So I can see your point. But then you met, of course, your darling wife through Patriotic Alternative.
Yeah. I remember complimenting her dress at that first conference just before
yellow
I left.
One. Yellow dress.
Yeah. And I think soon after that, because I was in, I think at that point, it was, she knew that I was the head of the 100 Handers, although it wasn't public at that point. But we talked about doing, it's like, oh, we should have a, you know, coffee sometime and talk politics and everything. And I basically gave her a time, a place. And she was like, "Oh, right, okay, yeah, sure." And picked her up. And at the time, I rode a motorbike, and you know what that's like. It's like women can't resist. So from there, we quickly got together.
I should say, 100 Handers is the name of your sticker operation.
Yes,
And you got together, and then you have a child.
We've got two now, yeah.
But at that point, you had one, the Catherine, and then it. There starts to be these problems. So how did that begin? Tell me what was the first thing that happened?
First thing that happened, I was exposed by Hope Not Hate as the head of the 100 Handers in late 2020. And the only thing that happened from that was I had a paid suspension from work, at which point I got another job. And then nothing seemed to happen police-wise. You know, there was no arrests. There didn't seem to be people hanging around the house or anything. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I designed the 100 Handers. I designed all these stickers to stay within British law. I guess I did the right thing, and I'm not going to get nicked. And then 6 months later, in April 2021, all of a sudden, on my way to work, I was arrested. And from there, they took the keys from my pocket. They went to our house, let themselves in, and didn't announce themselves or anything, but walked in on Laura while she was still in bed. She thought it was like Antifa who had come to kick her head in or something, because it was plainclothes police officers, and they hadn't shouted, you know, "It's the police here," or anything like that, or let themselves in. And they basically turned the house upside down, took absolutely every electronic device going. And I was informed that I think there were three charges. It was distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred, which is what finally went to court. But there was another two, one for possession of terrorist material and something to do with like international funding of terrorism. Like I'd been receiving funds or something along those lines. And by the time we got to questioning, I'd been in a cell for a few hours at this point. They began questioning me about funding and everything. And then an officer came through the door and went, we're dropping those first two charges. We're just going with the distribution thing. And they're like, oh, right, okay, cool. And what continued was 4 hours of questioning, basically. They can only do 2 hours at a time before they have to give you a break. And prior to that first break, they said, we just found out Laura's pregnant and she'd obviously made them aware of this during the search. And they said, it's like, you know, with this distribution charge, Sam, it's like you're looking at 10 years and I mean, Laura's pregnant, you know that. And it's like, so, and they kind of left me to go off and ruminate before questioning me again. But it didn't result in anything there and then. I was released pending investigation and we didn't hear anything for 2 years after that. Until eventually we started harassing them to basically get our devices back. You know, they'd taken Laura's work laptop, my work computer, everything in the house. So we kind of had to start fresh in that regard. And we own a mail order tea and coffee company. So having computers is pretty important. And eventually they landed the charges and they delivered them and they looked a bit disheartened. The sergeant in charge of the case had been very confident at the start. And then when he's handing us these charges, he seemed really let down. I mean, he's a counter-terror sergeant, so I'd imagine he probably was really hoping for a big fish here, and turns out it was just me. But yeah, it was distribution of material, and then encouraging racially aggravated criminal damage for the actual stickers on the laptops. And that one we were really surprised about, because I don't think there's ever been anyone charged with criminal damage for stickers on public street furniture. You know, it's...
No, it's just normal things to put up stickers. Put up stickers all the time.
Yeah, political groups, religions, and they have URLs so you can identify who's put them up and everything, but it's never pursued, except in the case of when you want to have kind of more pro-white, anti-immigration messaging.
So so what year are we in now when you were finally charged?
Finally charged was 2023. And then 2023. The court date was then set for like the following year in 2024.
Right, and so then it was, and so I mean, this must have put you under. So this is a long process, 2020, 2 years, and then another year, so 3 years.
Yeah.
What did this do? This must have put you under, you and Laura, under stress all the time.
Yeah, I mean, was it? We were talking the other day and realised that it's like basically for as long as me and Laura have been together, there's been this kind of hanging over us. And as of March 1st of this year, it was finally over, like kind of 5 years essentially of just pressure, knowing that the state has like the kind of ISR on upon you. But following my arrest, my political output, you know, doubled, tripled. You know, all of a sudden we were doing megaphone demos outside migrant hotels, banner drops, you know, protests all over the place and everything. Basically, it's like a F you to the state. You know, we weren't going to let it shut us down. And we knew that it was kind of unfounded. We felt very confident going into the trial that it's like, no, I took so many precautions while engaging in this stickering campaign to stay within the law and encourage others to stay within the law when stickering and everything, that I thought it'd be kind of a done deal that I'd get a not guilty on this.
Yes, I remember because I interviewed Laura about this while you were inside, mm-hmm. And she would say that one of the things they used against you was what, that they found her book about her Oswald Mosley book or something.
Yeah, apparently I've got a fascination and obsession with Oswald Mosley, despite pretty much all the Oswald Mosley material in this house being hers. The fact that it was on the bedside table meant that it was mine. And despite Laura taking to the stand and saying, that is mine, and we entered into the evidence, the Amazon receipt, when she ordered the book. And it's like, but that just didn't pay any mind. It's the whole trial was basically like a character assassination to be able to paint me as a racist, and thus, by using the R word, basically trigger a immune response in the jury.
And they also that they found a poster of Hitler that you had on a wall a wall in a garage that you rented as for a gym during COVID.
Yeah, because you know, obviously, me and my friends we're called Nazis all the time, so it's a bit of a laugh for us. And one of them bought me a poster as a joke, and I'd put it up in the gym, basically raised up behind the pull-up bar. And the joke was, it's like, oh, you know, the only way to look him in the eye is to be able to do a pull-up and everything, because we're just a bunch of like 30-something-year-old kind of pudgy guys or whatever. It's like clearly not the Ubermensch or whatever. And it's like, oh, that's a good laugh. And then all of a sudden you find that it's like your inside joke of your friends you're now having to explain to a jury who have absolutely no context whatsoever. And it's like most inside jokes, they can't be explained. It just comes across as mental. But from that poster, then the prosecution was kind of like, so you think the Holocaust is something to laugh about, do you? And I was like, it's just a joke, dude. It's like you're really going reading too far into this. But it's, you know, these kind of things.
Lucky you didn't say, hang on, okay, Hitler messed up with the Holocaust. But there were many good things he did. I mean, come on.
Yeah, love dogs.
what about his animal rights laws?
Yeah.
So and my understanding was that with the trial, it wasn't the trial round about the time of the of some kind of incident with Rudikubana, wasn't it round about that time? When was the trial?
It wasn't Rudikubana, he was while I was inside, but the Palestinian protests had kind of really kicked up in London. They'd made I think there'd been like death threats to the MPs and stuff like that who were pro Zionist. And that had led to the judge kind of having an about turn because he seemed kind of tacitly on our side, kind of openly kind of free speechy during the trial. But when we came to sentencing a month after the guilty verdict, it was like a different guy. And he explicitly said that he's using this to make an example of political activists who engage in anti-Semitism because of the Palestinian protests going on. And I was just like, that's somehow my fault now. But yeah, it was poor timing. But then at the same time, you know, obviously after Rudikubana, there was that unrest in August, and it's like, should my trial have happened after that? I think instead of 2 years, I'd have been looking at 5 to 7. You know, they were hammering like some of these protesters with worse sentences than I got, and all they did was throw a traffic cone.
I talked to a Russian friend of mine at the time when this happened to you, and he said it's what we call in Russia telephone justice. It's the judges telephoned and told, right, look, I don't know what you're thinking of sentencing this guy to, but it needs to be more because an example needs to be made of him, and these are the reasons. And that would explain why he was a completely different guy, why he had a complete volte-face, because of political pressure, possibly, to make an example.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing I couldn't possibly say happened, however... appearances would imply that possibly something like that had occurred.
So then, I mean, if you don't mind, I mean, you do talk about it a bit in the book, but what? So, I mean, you must have been absolutely in shock when he sentenced you to whatever it was.
Leveled, because in that month prior, we'd had a pre-sentence report, which is basically probation talks to you and gets an idea of your life situation, work, family, all this kind of thing, to basically judge whether would it be positive for you to have a custodial sentence, you know, will it break a cycle of crime or anything like that. And the pre-sentence report recommended a suspended sentence and I think a couple hundred hours of community service. So again, we were going into that trial thing, it's like, well, you know, they've recommended it, but it didn't come to be. I'd packed a bag, but it was kind of a symbolic packing a bag for prison, you know, two of everything. And I hadn't even packed a change of shoes, so it's like I ended up kind of running around the exercise yard in my dress shoes from court. You know, it was just I really wasn't expecting it at all.
And so how did you feel? Does it feel like, my God, is this a night? Does it feel like it's not happening? How does it feel?
Yeah, I mean, especially as well at this point, Laura was heavily pregnant with our second child as well, and I knew that a custodial sentence would mean that I'd be missing the birth of her. So when he came out and he was, you know, so sober and solemn and everything, I was like, this guy's going to stick me, and I kind of just locked eyes with him, and I refused to present him with any emotion because I didn't want him to know he was getting to me. But as soon as they took me into the cell at the back, I just I just broke down because it's like 3 years had led to this point, and now.
Are you ready for the future of the West? Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.